We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Emil Zatopek, considered to be one of the greatest runners of the 20th century, the 5K, 10K, and marathon gold medalist at the 52 Olympics, and known for his brutal training methods, said, "If one can stick to the training throughout the many long years, then willpower is no longer a problem. It's raining? That doesn't matter. I'm tired? That's besides the point. It's simply that I just have to." The reason I mentioned that quote is I got a chance to talk to Travis Stevens, a two-time judo Olympian, at the end of his training day that included three training sessions on the mat and one strength and conditioning session. He answered a few questions over email, and then we talked on the phone for 30 minutes. So I'm doing something a little different where I'm just going to play that interview and then read some of his answers, which I thought were very interesting. Here we go.
You've mentioned you've been struggling with an ankle injury lately. To what degree do you train through injuries? How bad does an injury have to be to keep you off the mat?
It has to be to the point to where any sort of exercise endangers my ability to do my job permanently.
Permanently?
Yeah, permanently. Like in China, in I think 2010 when I took bronze, the Russian caught me in an arm lock off of Uchimata and fractured my elbow. But when I came back to the doctor, I was like, what are the odds that it gets worse? He's like, well, it can always get worse, but basic movement was okay. There was pain, but I could still, like, flex. I still touch my thumb to my chest. I could kind of straighten it all the way. So all I did was tape it, train through Christmas for World Masters, and competed.
Awesome.
I fought senior nationals in 2009 with four broken ribs and five torn cartilage ribs and still won. And then trained through the worlds with that same injury. So it has to be fairly extensive for me to actually like, hey, I can't compete anymore. I can't train. I have to stay off of it. And even then to like stay off of it completely is almost a no-go. Like, when I tore my hamstring in 2012 in January, I was in the gym 3 days later when I got home from the training camp. Wow. Like, I still don't take time off. I'm always working through injuries. You know, even when I broke my foot, the day after surgery, I got on a plane, flew home, and went straight to the gym. And started lifting upper body because I had a job to do.
Right. You talk about that good training is the kind of training where your mind is engaged. So you're constantly working on specific things that you're trying to improve. If you're carrying an injury, are you able to mentally maintain focus throughout training?
That's one of the reasons why you have to be mentally really strong to train through an injury, because you have to be well aware of what your capabilities are. Like when I first came back full speed with my torn hamstring, I couldn't do hip throws like Uchimata, like Harai, because I couldn't sweep my leg and have that extension and that pull on my hamstring for the throw, because there was too much of a risk of tearing it again, because I always come back probably like a month or two before I really should.
Right.
So I have to avoid all those throws entirely. Even if the guy's showing it to me and I see it and I can put him through the floor, I have to let it go and just work and develop other things.
Right, so with your ankle, you don't have to answer this, but with your ankle, are there throws you're staying away from?
Yeah, there are. I still can't do Ochi, I can't do Koji, I can't do a hopping Uchimata. Osoto is really difficult because I can't turn the corner when I hook in. So I try them, but I end up stumbling and falling over before I ever get a chance to finish it because my ankle just gives out.
But your Yoko and your Seinagi are still good to go.
Some versions of my Seinagi are still okay and some aren't. But my Tomonagi is 100% okay because I use my right ankle, not my left.
One of the interesting things is, in Jiu-Jitsu's perspective, a lot of the people complain that the stand-up fighting is the exhausting part of their matches. In judo, do you find the stand-up, like the gripping and the throw attempts, more exhausting than the groundwork, or vice versa?
That's kind of a funny question, because neither one to me is exhausting. Because I don't really have a fear of either one.
Right.
Jiu-jitsu players find the stand-up more exhausting because they're afraid of it. So when they stand up, their heart rate rises, which causes their blood to pump faster, and they start breathing heavier because they're nervous. Right. Or in some cases, they stop breathing at all because they flex their whole body in fear of getting thrown or taken down.
Right.
So that's where the exhaustion comes from. It's not from like, that's like saying I'm standing around and standing up, but I'm getting tired.
Right. Got it. It's from the fear.
It's from the fear of, because they're not comfortable in that position.
So a lot of judo players will use the groundwork as a moment to rest. So when it goes to the ground, it's time to rest. I mean, when I watch your matches, you go hard on the feet and you go hard on the ground. Is that just because you're mentally prepared to go, you know, the full 5 minutes all out, no matter where?
That, and I use the groundwork more for clock management and time management than I do for anything else. I mean, a lot of it is I know that I'm comfortable there. So I know, like, the more I feel like I'm flexing and, like, stiffen up, the more I want to do the groundwork, because I know he's struggling to breathe because he's flexing his whole body.
Right.
So I know he's going to get really tired and fatigued down there, regardless of whether I get him or not. A lot of times I'll just roll a guy around for 30, 40 seconds just to make him tired. And if he gives me something, he gives me something. If not, I still consider it a great exchange because he's exhausted, and for me, groundwork is easy.
Right.
I'm comfortable anywhere on the ground.
Like you said, if you don't have a fear of it, then it's not as exhausting.
Yeah.
Are you being coached by Jimmy Pedro right now?
And his father, yes.
And his father, yeah. So at this stage in your career, what kind of interaction do you have with Jimmy? What do you take from him in terms of a coach-athlete relationship? Like, does he adjust some of the gripping, some of the techniques that you do still?
Yeah, all the time. All the time, especially with, like, the new rules where we bounce a lot of ideas back and forth off of each other. And then once we have two or three ideas, it's time to go to a training camp and see what pans out.
Right.
Because on paper, a lot of ideas seem great until you actually get there and the guy doesn't react the way you think he does, or, you know what, it's impossible to get to that situation. So we always come up with a few ideas for certain players or certain situations, and then take those ideas to the training camp and try them out in live situations. And a lot of times I get dumped on my head because of it, but that's the nature of the beast.
So, I mean, you're coaching yourself a little bit now, and what do you think is like, what do you think optimally is the role of a coach early in the development of an athlete? So you're like at your prime right now, but when you're first starting out, what is the role of the coach?
You got to really focus on not so much winning and losing, but good decisions and bad decisions. Because there's no situation in judo or jiu-jitsu that doesn't have a counter to it.
Right.
Like, you could time a throw perfectly, and that guy could time his counter perfectly, but that doesn't necessarily mean that what that player did was wrong. So a coach has to be there to reassure him that, like, no, you're doing the right thing. You just have to perfect it a little bit more before you start seeing W's adding up. Where some coaches will see, like, oh, well, you went in for an Uchimata, for example, and you keep getting picked up. Oh, well, forget doing Uchimata, rather than, like, fixing the problem at hand.
Right.
That doesn't mean he's not doing it right. He is maybe doing it to the wrong types of players.
I asked you a question that you answered well about, like, your toughest opponent, and you mentioned that you don't really remember, like, the toughest opponent. The matches you've lost were ones where you made a mental mistake, you slipped up. So the question I have is, do you find it difficult to, in the middle of a match, if you slipped up and you're down on points, to regain focus and come back? Is that something that you prepare yourself for? Is that something you're able to do?
Yeah, but it's a lot easier, believe it or not, to be losing and come back and win than it is to be winning and then have to hold on to it against certain players.
Yeah, I see that a lot in competition. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, there are some players out there that, like, I won't even try to score on until, like, the last minute. Because I know once they get scored on, they go into, like, tape mode and they start going crazy, and then it's hard to fend off everything. So you might as well keep it at an even keel until the last minute or so. That way when you do score, hopefully they're exhausted from the previous 4 minutes to not be able to go as crazy. You can kind of manage it a little bit better.
In terms of points, you've had a lot of really tough matches in the Olympics and just in general, but the matches you've had, as you mentioned, the ones you lost were extremely close matches. How tough is it to lose on a ref decision or on a Shido or on a Yuko on a very small margin? What goes through your mind on a loss like that?
It really depends on the circumstances, because sometimes, like, when you get a penalty, you're like, you know what? I screwed up. I deserve that. I feel like I actually lost. In the Olympics, I didn't think I lost.
Yeah.
So that kind of mentally destroyed me for the rest of the day, for the rest of the year, actually. I kind of couldn't really get it out of my head, because when I was fighting the bronze medal match, I kept looking over at the scoreboard, and there's that little part in the corner that says bronze,
yeah,
like right underneath the weight category. And I kept staring at that going, what am I doing here? Like, how did this happen? Because when you're getting ready for the games, you never think of yourself in a bronze medal match.
Right.
And then to not have made a mistake up until then,
yeah,
yet I'm there anyways, I couldn't figure it out. And rather than focusing on the match at hand and, like, getting through it, I was trying to play back in my head that whole match of where was my mistake and how did I get here, which I never should have been doing.
You know, you train really, I mean, I hate to sound dramatic, but it's your whole life is that match. That, you know, the Olympics, you know, 99.99% of people never get to accomplish something that great, and it rides on that one little decision by a referee. It's amazing. But you're saying that you need to just put that behind you and continue on in the bracket.
I wouldn't say put it behind you, as much as you need to accept it.
Yeah.
Like, what's done is done, but to say put it behind you is kind of like an almost unrealistic idea.
So that's something that's going to be with you for the rest of your career, that match, especially in 2012.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get emails probably like every 4 days. I'll get an email or a Facebook message or something that says, hey, I just rewatched your match. I still think you got robbed.
Yeah.
You know, you should have won the gold medal, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I agree 100%. But 100 years from now, when people look at the record book, I took a fifth.
Well, that's going to make the 2016 gold that much sweeter.
Not really.
No?
I mean, that's what a lot of people like to think. But you know what? Tournaments come around one time. Like, Paris 2013 already happened. You can't go back and win it. There's nothing you can do in the future to bring that feeling of winning that tournament back. Because when you look back at my career, because I lost in that semi, I won't have 2 Olympic medals. If
right.
that decision had gone my way, even if I had lost in the finals, I would have been a 2-time Olympic medalist, and I'll
right.
never have that title. Because even if I win 2 Olympics, I should have had 3.
Yeah, and that's going to be with you forever. You and Dan Gable with the Larry Owings loss, it's going to be with you forever.
Yeah, there's no going back, because my career will never have been what it could have been because of that loss, because of that ref's decision.
That's tough. You've mentioned training to the point of exhaustion as something that you've learned to love, like that you love the feeling of taking yourself to, you know, to complete exhaustion as a sort of sign that you're doing something right in your training. Did you always have a love for that kind of thing, or did you develop it through your career? Because I hear that from a lot of high-level guys, that is, they learn to sort of cherish that feeling of just complete exhaustion?
Cherish is a good word for it, because when you're younger and you're coming up, you kind of run into it all the time. Like, everyone is always getting tired. When you're at that, like, national level or just breaking into the international scene, everyone's better than you, or everyone's just as good as you. So it's not unheard of for you to, like, have training partners that can push you to that breaking point. But once you reach that, like, really, like, elite status where even the, like, 40 through, like, 100 stage of the world ranking list aren't even a threat to you, and you could beat them in your sleep or one-handed or however you want to put it, it's really difficult to come by that feeling of, like, wow, I've really pushed myself. Because in our sports and in combat sports, it takes two people. It takes a room of people to push yourself to get it. This isn't track and field or swimming where you can go to a track and run your hardest.
Right.
Feel accomplished. You need another individual who's willing to go the distance and reach that level of exhaustion with you.
Do you go to the point where it's also mental exhaustion, like where you're mad at yourself, where you start making mistakes and your judo starts breaking down? Do you get to that?
I usually reach mental exhaustion before physical exhaustion. Right. So for me, it's getting to that physical point that's really, really difficult.
Right.
Unless it's like the month after coming back from a major injury, then it's really, really easy.
I don't know if it's on purpose, but I've seen a lot of your matches, and sometimes it looks like you're smiling when you get up, like in those, like you should be exhausted, but it looks like you're smiling. Is that something you do? Is that a genuine smile, or is that something you do to show your opponent that you're not tired?
No, that's like a genuine smile. It just kind of happens sometimes, because I really do enjoy competing, and like sometimes it's just comical at like some of the stuff that happens.
Right.
Like if I make a mistake on the ground and a guy like gets into a situation where he should have won but was like so shocked that he got there he was unsure of what to do and couldn't capitalize on it, I find that hilarious.
Yeah.
It's like I dodged a bullet and I get another life.
Right. You talked about recently on that you're a tough training session for you means that you know something where you're trying to perfect, you're trying to learn a new technique. How often do you learn like new details for gripping or throws? Still, do you learn new things? Still, do you find yourself learning new things in judo?
To learn new things is probably not the correct wording I should have used. It's more of bringing things back.
Back into focus.
I mean, everybody. Yeah, back into focus and trying to figure out a way to implement it back into your system. Because, for instance, like if you're like a traditional judo player and you play collar sleeve, and then all of a sudden you want to develop a sumi, well, now you have to develop a new gripping strategy because you can't do a sumi from a traditional collar sleeve grip. So now you have to figure out how to keep setting up your Uchimatas and your Osotos from your collar sleeve. But now you have to develop those same throws from that sumi grip so that you don't just have one move. So it's like, oh, the guy knows where I'm going to go. You have to have another option. So it's not necessarily a new throw, but a new way to do it or a new gripping strategy to go from one to the other and back again for different setups.
Got you, man. What are your plans for in terms of competitions in the upcoming months?
I leave for Germany for the Bundesliga final on Tuesday, and then I come back and I do the World BJJ Expo in Long Beach.
Jiu-Jitsu, yeah.
And then I go to Abu Dhabi and then Tokyo, and then I head to Paris for the European Club Cup Championships.
Amazing, man.
And that'll end it for the year.
That will end it for the year. That's awesome, man. And you're doing this kind of strategy of you're keeping your jiu-jitsu and judo almost completely separate in terms of your game plan and the kind of game you're implementing on the mat, right?
Yeah, entirely. Like, my judo is, like, I have to win. That's it. So it's very, like, focused and, like, if I have to grind through a position and really force it and, like, bury my head in your face to, like, get a pass or get the pin, that's what I'll have to do. And jiu-jitsu, if I run into a wall, like, I'll cartwheel this way or roll that way and, like, just kind of move around it just because it's fun for me.
Right.
I don't mind, like, I don't have to sit in one position and grind it out for 2 minutes to get 2 points. I'll just go somewhere else. And I try to have more fun with it that way, kind of like that back kick I did to Meow. It's like, I'm not going to really try to go through your guard because you're not going to let me, so I'm going to figure out a way to go around it.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, that was a beautiful back take, by the way. That would have been so awesome if you stabilize it. It'd probably be one of the only people I've ever seen that have seen Miao's back. That was beautiful.
Not bad for a judo guy.
Yeah, not bad for a judo guy. Against a brown belt, absolute world champion. Yeah. The question I have is, this is something that comes up often, would you rather win a match on Cheetos or lose going for Ippon for big throws?
I mean, I guess that depends on the match.
Obviously, in the Olympics, winning is everything. But so you just won gold in the Grand Prix. So in a tournament like that, that's basically, you know, it's exceptionally high-level tournament, but it's not the Olympics. Do you find yourself taking more risks?
Yeah, I'm always taking risks. Always. Because I just want to, I have no problem, like, if I think a throw's, like, 40% there, 30% there, I'll take a shot. Because I'm really comfortable with, okay, we're in a situation, and then I'll figure it out along the way. Like, I'm really good at playing that, well, I'm coming in for Osoto, you're going to do this counter, I'm going to do this counter, and you're going to do that counter. I feel like I can react faster than you to come out ahead,
right,
for instance. So I have no problem taking, like, risky shots to benefit from it. And I did it in the final of the Uzbekistan Grand Prix, and I ended up scoring with it because what happened was the guy grabbed my neck. I ducked under his hand earlier in the match and got a Cheeto for it. Because the rule states if you duck under, you have to immediately attack.
Right.
So I ducked under a second time because I knew he was going to pause and hope for a Cheeto. So I used that duck under to kind of fit in for an Ogoshi and then hooked in the Osoto and scored. But it wasn't something that was ever planned. I just knew once I hipped in that he didn't go forward, so I reacted backwards.
Right.
But I had no intention when I ducked under of coming in for that Osoto. That was just kind of a reaction based off of what he did.
Do you get frustrated with, so in the finals of the Grand Prix you were just in, you went against a guy who, I think he's from Iran? I'm not
sure.
He won three matches in a row without scoring a point. He won on Cheetos. He basically was a very sort of cagey, strategic player. Do you find guys like that very, very frustrating? I mean, arguably, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but sometimes when Ole Bischoff goes against you, he seems to have a similar approach. What do you do mentally against a guy who just doesn't seem to open up, is not interested in scoring points?
For me, that makes it somewhat easier because if I know they're not going to try to throw me, that means I can just unload whenever I want. If I, like, want to jump into a Ochi or if I want to jump into an Osoto or fling an Uchimata, I can because I know in his head he's not trying to score. So he's not looking for opportunities to score, which means he's also not looking for opportunities to counter.
Right.
But there's a difference between somebody not scoring and somebody looking for counters too.
Well,
like the guy from Iran had scored no points all day.
Right.
So I know he's not coming into the final with a different game plan of, oh, now I'm going to open up in the final.
There's guys that are searching for counters. How do you approach guys like that?
A lot of gripping and a lot of footwork. Because guys who are looking for counters are usually sitting on their heels. So a lot. And now with them not being able to grab the legs, you don't see it too much. that used to be something where people would wait for a big Uchimata or a Ponce Nagi, and they'd wrap you up and then pick you up. But now that they can't grab the leg, people are kind of getting away from just counter judo.
Which is a good thing. But how's your last question to you real quick. How did the new rules change your game? I've seen you throw some big katagurumas. Has it changed your game in any other way?
The original rule set helped me. When you couldn't just off the grip attack the legs, you had to wait for there to be some sort of engagement before you could grab the leg. I was happy with that rule change. When they took it out completely, I was okay with it. When they changed the rules on how you could grip and break grips, that really, really hurt me. Like, really hurt me. And it's taken a lot of work to, like, figure it out. And that was one of the, like, most frustrating things to go through.
Are you still going through that?
Still going through it till this day. And it's so frustrating. I hate it with a passion.
Well, man, you're one of the most exciting judo players to watch, not just in America, but in the world. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you do in on the judo competition scene and jiu-jitsu. Going to tear up some guys. You did extremely well in the Copa Podio, and I can't wait to see you in maybe do some damage in the World Championships as well. So thanks for talking to me, man. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for giving me a call.
And here's the conversation that we had over email. If you're the type that likes to read, then I posted a link to the text version of this interview. But if you want to just listen, then here it is. I first asked, you've trained in both jiu-jitsu and judo and competed in some epic matches in both sports. What do you love the most in competition, a big throw or a big submission? Travis said, well, for jiu-jitsu, it's only about the submission. You don't really gain anything for throwing your opponent through the floor. 2 points is 2 points, regardless of how they fall. But for judo, I like to throw. I love putting people through the floor. It gives you such a rush of pleasure. But I end up beating people on the ground because it's so much easier for me. Judo players make so many mistakes, it's hard for me to not capitalize on them. I've been in some judo matches where I try not to capitalize on these mistakes, but when they don't fix these mistakes or keep leaving their arm out, I'm going to take it, and I try to break it out of pure annoyance that they just don't know any better. I take it as an insult that they feel they don't have to protect it, so they don't. I asked, from having watched your matches, it seems you have wisely approached your jiu-jitsu ground game very differently than your judo ground game, Niwasa. In both technique and philosophy, what do you think is the difference and what's required to win on the ground in sport judo versus sport jiu-jitsu? Timing, intensity? Travis said, in judo, I'm just a mean SOB. If I have to throw a right hook to get my hand under your chin, so be it. Or if you don't let me grab the back of your collar, I'll just start smashing your face into the mat in frustration. In judo, I have such a small window to work with and a lot fewer moves to be able to pick from. I approach it with the faster, more violent, and aggressive I can attack the position, the better. Most of this is because the refereeing in judo doesn't have the knowledge to know if you're close or just BSing it. So they stop a lot of things early when they shouldn't and let a lot of things go for long when they shouldn't. In BJJ, there's only one move I do that I use in judo and jiu-jitsu. I keep everything else 100% different, including takedowns. I respect the technical side of jiu-jitsu a ton and try never overpower or run throw anyone. I try to use my movement to create opportunities and use my creative thinking to try and make things happen that people would have never seen coming. I also try to stick to a lot of leg locks in BJJ. I love foot locks, and I use them every chance I get, even if I have to give a position. I asked, you have a new instructional DVD out with Jimmy Pedro called The Takedown Blueprint that covers some of the most effective judo techniques for jiu-jitsu competitors, including Seinagi, Taitoshi, Tomonagi, Sumigaishi, Ouchi, Osoto, Katagaruma, and more. In judo, your style of Seinagi is similar in footwork and gripping to the Koga Seinagi. How did you develop your standing sail? And do you think it's an effective technique for high-level jiu-jitsu? Are there adjustments that would make it more effective? Travis answered, I evolved my standing seo over the years of training, just trial and error. It clearly works in high-level BJJ competitions, as I used it in Copa Podio, but I would not recommend that throw to people. I would recommend a dropping one. It's just too dangerous. Your back can be taken very easily. My body and muscles needed to pull off that throw are very developed through years of doing it. There are a lot of easier throws to develop that will score you 2 points and will show these takedowns in the DVD. I asked, we've recently talked about Tamerlan Tamenov striking fear into the hearts of his opponents. Has there ever been an opponent in judo or jiu-jitsu who you feared facing? If so, how did you overcome that? Travis answered, this is a joke, and I laugh at people that get scared. How can you fear someone in a competition? There are rules in place to protect the competitors. If you look at a list of people competing and you fear someone in the bracket, just quit and go home and save your money and don't waste the time of the people who want to compete. Because what you really fear is yourself. You don't have the confidence within yourself. You think you don't have the ability, and if that's the case, why bother? You should be itching to fight the best and prove yourself, not hiding in a corner hoping for easy street to just land at your feet. I asked, you faced Oleh Bischoff several times with exceptionally close matches. He was the 2000 and 2012 Olympic gold and silver medalist. Has he been your toughest opponent? Travis answered, no, Bischoff was not my toughest opponent. He didn't have throwing capability. And if memory serves me right, he has only beat me on penalties. But I've never seen opponents as tough. Yeah, I lose matches, but not because my opponents are so great, but because I make mental errors or take risks that backfire. I asked, do you regularly visualize your matches leading up to competition? Do you have a specific game plan that you prepare and visualize for a particular style of opponent? Like righty, lefty, Georgian, Japanese style, etc. Travis answered, I do for left versus right, but not for individuals or for regions. I could care less what they do. I plan on going into the match and imposing what I want to do. But when I do visualize, my opponent is a blur, and I'm just focused on me. I asked, for the beginner, intermediate, and professional judo player and jiu-jitsu competitor, do you see drilling as an important part of training? Is it essential to get thousands of reps in on a technique before you can pull it off successfully in competition? Or is practicing the technique in randori, sparring, more important? Travis answered, they're both equally important. Drilling is far more important in jiu-jitsu because the moves are very foreign to the body. And there are so many types of positions you have to be familiar with that if you don't drill, you will always run into something you're not prepared for. For judo, you can do all the reps in the world, but if you're too scared to pull it off in live training, it will be all for nothing. So drilling is important, but developing a lack of hesitation for the judoka is even more important. I asked, I remember reading an interview with you by Dan Figella, where he draws a distinction between two learning paths, that of the soldier and that of the wanderer. He put you and Iliadis in the wanderer camp. You've traveled all around the world to train. Where did you look for the mental, not to mention financial support in your journey? I imagine it gets lonely putting your body through hell without a strong support structure back home. Does it? Travis answered, it doesn't get lonely at all. I wake up every morning excited to do my job and train. I want nothing more out of life than to be healthy enough for the next training session. The financial backing for it will always be there. And I never asked for handouts, but people were always willing to help because they saw the effort that I was putting in. And when there was no financial backing, I got the money myself, roofing houses, landscaping, you name it. I work any job if it put money in my pocket that could go toward my goal. I asked, you train 2 to 3 times a day. I imagine usually with very high intensity. Have you ever felt like not training or even quitting judo? How do you overcome days, thoughts like that? Travis answered, I only feel that way when I'm training in Japan. Everything there is so boring. I hate training there. But anywhere else in the world, I love it. and wish we could train more. That feeling of tired is what I love. Your body has been pushed to the limits. Your mind can't think straight. I live for that. And if I'm in a lot of pain, I just tell myself I'll feel better after. And I always do. I asked, is participating in camps and training sessions around the world like many European players do the key in creating successful judoka who is able to win world or Olympic titles? Travis, it's a part of it, but it's not the answer by any means. You have to want to learn. And when you step on the mat, you have to put your ego aside and be willing to see your faults and make adjustments. I asked, I started judo after watching it in the 2008 Olympics. You and Ronda Rousey are the two people I remember from that Olympics. I imagine there are other Americans like me that were inspired by your performance. As one of the best American judoka, do you feel pressure to represent your country and inspire new athletes to join the sport? Travis answered, I don't. I'm very happy to hear that people joined because they were inspired by my performance. It truly does a lot for me. But I know on the flip side, I can't make anyone do anything. I'm just happy that they tune in for their support. I asked, you're connected to the elite level of both jiu-jitsu and judo communities. What is your sense about the growth of both sports in the coming decades? Do you see the recent rule changes as positive for that growth? Travis answered, I wouldn't say I'm at the elite level of jiu-jitsu. I have the potential to get there, but I'm not there yet, at least in my eyes. But I think jiu-jitsu has gone as far as it will in growth in the United States. With the caps on the numbers of athletes as a whole rather than per division, I just don't see it growing. There's also no support for jiu-jitsu guys because they compete for clubs and not a country. There's no organizing body for these people to receive help from unless the clubs start taking on a more professional role and paying top athletes to compete and represent them. But I don't see that happening on a national level. Maybe a few guys here and there, but nothing wide range. Judo's rule changes are what they are. I hope that they take the sport to the next level. That way they haven't been for nothing. But it's hard to say. I don't know what gets discussed behind closed doors. And the last question I asked, do you like teaching? Do you see owning your own jiu-jitsu or judo academy in the future? Travis answered, I love teaching. I look forward to all my classes as if I was going to train. I love to see my students grow and learn. I currently own 2 jiu-jitsu schools and enjoy teaching in both. I wish there was more time in the day so I could live my dream longer. There you have it, folks. My monotone voice doing a crappy reenactment of the email interview. Go to Travis's Facebook and Twitter. He's very active on there and posts a lot of good information and just generally motivational stuff.